We are live on the internet, and we're calling this meeting of the Public Utilities Commission to order. It is November 24th at around 9:30 in the morning, and we're here in the State Capitol Building. This was the time and the place noticed for this meeting. We have an agenda. The only suggested change I have to order, if it pleases my colleagues, is to move the arbitration oral arguments to the end of the agenda. That would seem to be friendlier to those people that fall beneath them on the agenda. Hearing no objection, we'll go ahead and make that change, and we'll begin first under administrative item number one, and that is approval of the minutes of the commission meetings held on June 23rd, July 14th, August 11th, August 25th, September 8th, and the minutes of the ad hoc meeting on August 31st. Those minutes have been circulated. Are there any amendments or corrections? Hearing none, is there any action?
I'll motion to approve the minutes.
Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye, and those motions carry 3-0. Next, we'll get an update from Ms. Gregg on the Consumer Division.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 103 contacts since the last report was prepared for the November 10, 2009 Commission meeting. 22 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 43 of the contacts involved electric service, 7 contacts involved natural gas service, 1 contact involved gas and electric service, 4 contacts involved cell phone service, 1 contact involved the Keystone Pipeline, 15 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 2 contacts related to the Grain Warehouse Division. 8 contacts related to issues that were not regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. 2,259 of the 2,315 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved.
Any questions for Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, thanks very much, Ms. Gregg. Our first item under electric is EL09-018. That's the Black Hills Power rate case. The question before the commission today is, shall it grant intervention to any parties that have filed? We do have Dakota Panel, GCC Dakota Incorporated, Rushmore Forest Products, Sanford Underground Laboratory, Spearfish Forest Products, and the hospital that have filed as large user interveners, and we've also had some citizens file. Let's go ahead and first see if any of the those who have petitioned to intervene want to make any comment.
Chair Commissioner, this is Andrew Maraska. I am appearing pursuant to a pro hoc vici order. I appreciate the commission allowing us by telephone. And I am here on appearing on behalf of Dakota Panel, GC Dakota, Rush Forest Product, Ford Underground Laboratory, Spearfish Products, Rapid City Regional Hospital. And I don't have anything to add. I just wanted to note that I am here to address any questions any of the commissioners may have.
Okay, just one moment. Thanks very much. I apologize for the delay. I didn't have the list of residential consumers handy, but I do now. Residential consumers, Lilius Jarding, Bobby Handley, Carla Cook, and the South Dakota Peace and Justice Center, collectively known as the Residential Consumers Coalition. Any of those folks want to make any comment at this time? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, this is Sam Carusi, counsel for the Residential Consumers Coalition.
Yeah, Mr. Carusi, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. I would, of course, stand on my petition to intervene and would also like to make myself available for any questions that the commission may have as well. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Carusi. We'll now look at the petitioner, Black Hills Power, for their comments on the pending interventions.
And I represent Black Hills Power with regard to the rate increase application that's been made in this matter. First, we have no objection with regard to the industrial interveners that are represented by Drew Maratska and Bob Lee. With regard to the petition that's been made, that is designated as residential consumers petition to intervene as parties, we certainly do not object to that petition. We certainly have no objection any time customers wish to intervene in a matter. We do, however, do have some concerns about the entity that's denominated in the petition as South Dakota Peace and Justice Center. And our concerns stem from the fact that we really don't know who they are, what issues they intend to raise in this matter, what their agenda might be in this matter. And frankly, although we're not objecting, I'm not certain that they technically meet the requirements of the South Dakota Administrative Rules with regard to intervention in this matter. So again, we don't object, but we do have some concerns with regard to the South Dakota Peace and Justice Center, because they are not, as far as we know, a customer of Black Hills Power. We don't believe that they reside within our service territory. So we do have some concerns, but we're not objecting.
Well, Mr. Magnuson, I mean, I'll ask the question. I mean, from a practical standpoint, if no one objects, it would be highly unusual and unlikely for the commission to deny them intervention. You've raised concerns. I mean, are you asking the commission in any way to take action other than granting the petition?
We are, since we're not objecting, we understand then that it's likely that you would be granting them the right to intervene. But I think as this matter progresses, I think that it would be appropriate to ask South Dakota Peace and Justice Center some of the questions to address the concerns that we have raised.
Okay, thanks, and we'll certainly hear from them in a second. Chair's a little bit out of order. Normally I like to hear from all the parties before we take questions. So at this point, let's turn to staff for any comments they might have.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would recommend granting intervention to all those that have timely applied here. As for the Peace and Justice Center, I don't see much of a distinction between them and the Rapid City Hospital, to be quite honest. The hospital, you know, is asserting it's representing itself as well as all its clinics and all those various buildings associated with it. And because our hurdle here is so low, I just think, and I think Rapid City Hospital is an appropriate intervener also, but I'm not sure there's a big distinction between them and the Peace and Justice Center, so staff would recommend granting intervention to all.
Okay, any questions from commissioners? I'll have one from Ms. Kramer. Ms. Kramer, if memory serves, the hospital in their petition did note that they're a direct customer of Black Hills Power, and so there was a financial impact. Is that at least one differentiating factor between Peace and Justice and the hospital?
When I spoke to, and I'll just slaughter his name, so I'll call him Sam yesterday, the attorney for the petitioners, he thought that there may be some of the Peace and Justice members may be residents in the Black Hills service area.
Sure, and I think that was mentioned in their petition. Let's turn to Mr. Carusi. Any comments, any response you have to Mr. Magnuson's comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. I would assert, as we did in our petition, that the Peace and Justice Center is not claiming standing in its own right other than as representative of its members. Many of whom are customers of Black Hills Power. And on that basis, the Peace and Justice Center is requesting intervention. As far as Mr. Magnuson's concerns about the nature of the arguments that the Peace and Justice Center will be raising, I think that's more appropriately reserved for discovery as this matter progresses and not directly relevant to standing.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the commission grant intervention to the parties that have made petition to us.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioners.
With that, electric item number two is EL09-017. This is a joint request for an electric service rights exception between NPPD and Northwest Rural Public Power District. Do either of the parties wish to make comment?
Yes, I would like to. My name is Sue Lowski. I'm with Nebraska Public Power District in Columbus, Nebraska. NPPD has retail service area in South Dakota. There's a rural customer in this service area that has requested electric service to a new residence. NPPD's closest facilities are approximately 3,800 feet away from this residence, and NPPD would request that the customer make a contribution in aid of construction. Northwest Rural Public Power District has facilities just across the Nebraska-South Dakota border and approximately 400 feet from this customer. They're better located to serve this customer at this time and would not require a contribution in aid of construction. Northwest would propose to put a meter on their distribution line in Nebraska, and the customer would then build from the meter to their residence. NPPD feels that this is in the best interest of the customer and respectfully requests that the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission approve this joint request for electric service territory exception. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lowski. Anyone from Northwest RPPD wish to make comment? Hearing none, staff, any comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Rounds for staff. I would just highlight that Northwest is not going to have any facilities in the state. The customer is going to own the line that crosses into the state, and basically the customer is going to save around $14,000 with this exception. So since all the customers are in agreement, or all the parties are in agreement, I would recommend approval.
Thank you, Mr. Rounds. Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
First, I'd like to thank NPPD and NRPPD to making this come out for the customer and everybody. I'll motion in EL09-017 that the Commission approve the joint request for an electric service rights exemption.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Electric item number three is EL09-021. This is a joint request for an electric service territory boundary change between Xcel and Southeastern. Either Xcel or Southeastern wish to make comment?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox here from Xcel Energy. This is one of those housing developments that resides on the territory boundary line that has come up occasionally. We have a map that we've included that kind of depicts the existing line, and then it shows the overlay of the platted development. And you can see that there are lots that are split in some cases and by the territory line. So we've come to mutual agreement with Southeastern Electric and the developer to where we've proposed to readjust the territory line so that it would better encompass and more efficiently serve this housing development. So all parties are in agreement. We respectfully request approval.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. Staff, comment?
Thank you, Chairman. We did ask additional information about the trying to pin down the exact borderline, and I think we have as much information as we can gather regarding that. We just recommend approval.
Thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I would just first note, Mr. Jacobson, I do think those data requests helped, and when you just look at the blurb on the agenda, I mean, that makes it pretty clear that, you know, we've endeavored to make it easily identifiable what territory is what. I mean, I think that helps keep things straight as we on a go-forward basis. So thank you.
Yeah, in each one of these cases, we're trying to get it so it fits our new GIS system. So.
Excellent. Any comments or action? Any additional comments or action? I will move that the Commission approve the joint request for an electric service territory boundary change. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Thank you. Our second electric item number three is in the matter of the filing by MDU for approval of tariff revisions, and that's the question before the Commission today. Ms. Aberle for MDU, any comments?
Chairman, this is Tammy Eberle. This is really a tariff cleanup to remove the
the deviation in that in the on and off peak hours to accommodate the daylight saving standard changes that appear to be on a permanent basis now. Thank you.
Thank you. Staff, Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Kramer, any comments?
Thank you, Chairman. As Tammy related, this is just a cleanup to now that the new daylight savings time parameters seem to be permanent. This just corrects their tariff to make that change permanent.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I will move that the Commission approve the tariff revisions in EL09-023.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Our first item under natural gas is a filing by MDU for approval of a contract with Deviations with Countertops Incorporated. That's the question before the Commission today with a December 1st effective date. MDU, comments?
Chairman, thank you. Commissioners, this is Tammy Eberly with Montana Dakota again. And the request before you is to authorize a new contract for natural gas service with Countertops Inc. that deviates from the generally applicable firm general service rate 70 schedule to be effective December 1. Countertops is operating in the former Marilot facilities and has chosen to transport their interruptible natural gas custom requirements using a third-party supplier. Countertops does have a significant amount of firm requirements necessary for the plant operation. We have entered into an agreement where the interruptible requirements will be served under the standard large interruptible transportation service rate 82, with the first 600 DK per day sold as firm natural gas priced at a discounted distribution delivery charge of 70 cents per DK and the firm gas commodity charge applicable to firm customers as adjusted each month through the purchase gas cost adjustment. The contract meets the needs of the customer while providing benefits to our other Black Hills service area customers through the recovery of distribution-related fixed costs under the firm rate and pipeline capacity costs. I am available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Kramer?
Thank you, Chairman. As Tammy said, that this contract is for the former Marilot location, and the circumstances that allowed Marilot to have a contract with Deviation still exist in this circumstance, although the customer is a scaled-down version of what Marilot formerly was. So we just recommend approval of the contract.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Jacobson, you know, Ms. Eberly mentioned that there, even with the rate that's been agreed to, there's still a benefit to other customers. I don't have any reason to doubt that given the volumes we're talking about. Do you have a high confidence level that that's the case?
Yes. In response to staff questions, MDU did supply calculation, and it's a similar calculation as was used before to determine the benefits to the other customers. And I would agree that, yes, there is a definite benefit to the other customers as opposed to having this customer bypass the system or install alternative facilities.
So this is a good example of, you know, a win-win. It's certainly good for Countertops, but it's also good for other customers on the system.
That's true.
Okay, yes. Thank you. Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I'll motion natural gas item number 1, NG09-009, that the Commission approve the contract with Deviations and associated tariff revisions. With the December 1st, 2009 effective date.
My apologies. Thanks, Commissioner. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. We'll take up telecom item number 2, which is TC09-091. This is a filing made by McCook Telephone Company for an amended certificate of authority. Some interesting transactional history to this, and certainly want to open this up, amended COA, see if McCook Telephone Company has any comments.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Ryan Taylor with Cutler & Donahue, appearing on behalf of McCook Cooperative Telephone Company and its subsidiaries.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Taylor. Did you or Mr. Roth have any comments other than what's in your filing?
Sure. I can just elaborate on what is in the filing. McCook Cooperative Telephone Company presently has three subsidiaries. One of those subsidiaries is an operating local exchange carrier, Tri-County Telecom. The other two are Hanson Communications. That is just a holding company. It has no independent business of its own at this point in time. And the third is Emory Cablevision, which operates the cable television system in Emory, South Dakota. McCook is consolidating those three subsidiaries by a series of mergers into McCook Cooperative Telephone Company. At the conclusion of this, McCook Cooperative Telephone Company will be the sole surviving entity of these four, and at that point in time will be operating its existing exchanges and also will be the local exchange carrier in the Emory and Clayton exchanges presently operated by Tri-County Telecom. Also following this merger, the existing patrons of Tri-County Telecom, who are presently just customers of a telephone company, will become members of McCook Cooperative Telephone Company on an equal basis with the other existing members. And also, just as an aside to that, on January 1st, 2010, McCook Cooperative Telephone Company will change its legal name to Triotel Communications, Inc.
Thanks, Mr. Taylor. Comments from staff?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Terry LaBrie-Baker with staff. I think Mr. Taylor did a good job explaining the filing, and staff would just recommend approving the amended COA for McCook to include the exchanges of Emory and Clayton.
Thanks very much. Any questions?
Yes, Ms. Baker, would this affect in any way the dollars that would come into any of these companies through the universal service funding?
As far as the ETC certification, I did not check into that to see if McCook would need to get approval as far as that yet. And maybe Mr. Roth can address that.
Mr. Commissioner, we are working with NECA on that issue. And following the merger, McCook is entitled to all of the rights that were previously held by Tri-County.
Thanks, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Roth, anything to add?
Good morning, Commission. Actually, we're keeping the same study areas through NECA, so there shouldn't be anything changing with the USF. That should remain the same. We are keeping two separate study areas with those companies. So,
thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I mean, I'll just... of course, we're only dealing with the COA today and not, you know, any of the merger activity. But, I mean, I would just say to Mr. Roth and you know, his team, I mean, I think this is great news for the customers. You know, we've seen this happen more first with Golden West and now with you all. I think this is a really good development, certainly one of the benefits that you all talk about of the independent telephone community. Many of them is the cooperative membership, and it's good to see that all those customers are going to have those benefits. All the local exchange customers anywhere are going to have those benefits. So good news for your new member owners, no doubt. So.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We've gone through that in the past. We've, you know, the old co-op, the old McCook would have been the smallest company we have if we hadn't gone through the merger with some of the Quest purchases in the past as well, too. So thank you very much.
Other comments or action?
Just out of curiosity, has there been any of your customers that have any apprehension of all the merger, or is everyone happy to be coming into the co-op?
You know, we had we went through our annual meeting here in September, and we did have two negative votes against it. I would just relate that to some people always disagreeing with some things. But on the Tri-County side, we have not. We've heard all good compliments. We've been very involved with the Emory community as well, too. So I spent a lot of time down there and money on different projects they've got as well, too. So.
Well, I would think for the size of this merger to bring everyone into the co-op, that's pretty commendable that out of the thousands, there's only two. So my congratulations on that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Roth, is it possible, and again, this is, you know, tangential to the question before us, but just out of curiosity, I mean, could people have voted no because there's a dilution of their possible dividend? Might there be a financial angle?
There could have been a portion of that. I know a couple of the members that were in attendance were a little upset with us with some of the fiber to the home project we had going, plowing through some of their ditches and stuff that year. So I think that probably reflected a couple of those votes, actually, is what it is. So that we expected a little bit of it.
Thanks. Comments or action? I will move that the commission grant the amended COA to McCook Cooperative Telephone Company. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Thanks. Telecom item number 3 is TC09-097. This is a filing by Sprint for approval of revisions to its access to service tariff. Comments from Sprint. Hearing and seeing no one from Sprint, comments from Ms. LaBrie-Baker and Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Chairman. Sprint has proposed introducing 8YY toll-free transit traffic service and other toll-free changes, and staff has reviewed the filing and recommends approving the tariff revisions with an effective date of November 19th.
Thanks very much. Any questions? Yes, Commissioner Colbeck.
Ms. Baker, did you say the 18th, November 18th as an effective date?
The 19th.
19th.
Yep, I think that's the 30-day.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. LaBrie-Baker, I mean, this isn't the kind of filing that we've necessarily seen a lot of. Were there anything in particular the commission should be paying attention to or any sources of concern in this? I mean, I didn't see anything, but you've certainly given it, more diligence than perhaps I have.
I didn't see anything either. If you recall, about a month ago, they had filed the same filing, and there was an intervener, and so they withdrew so they could clear up some language and get that cleared up with the intervener. They've done that, and now it's being refiled, and there was no interventions this time, so I'm assuming that language all got worked out. And this was filed in other states as well, so.
Great, thanks very much. Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I will move that in TC09-097 that the Commission approve the access service tariff.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, yes.
I want to add the effective date.
And that was the 19th, if memory serves?
That's what staff recommended.
Okay.
That is included in the motion.
Okay. Any discussion on the revised motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. With that, we will turn to telecom item number 1, which is the interconnection agreement arbitrations that we've been dealing with for a while. We really have two different issues to deal with here. The first is Altel's motion to reconsider, and the second is oral argument. I'll just look to counsel. I mean, do you want to argue these together, or do you want to deal with one first and then the other? Ms. Moore? Okay. For those on the internet and for the archive, neither counsel indicated any problem with just taking the two of them together. Staff, any concerns with that?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Kramer. With that, let's move into oral arguments on both issues then. The only issue is here now order gets to be a little bit of an interesting party, and the movements are different on this. So who wants to take the first crack? All right, Ms. Moore, you're up.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners, staff. I will start my comments with regard
to the arbitration as a whole, and I think the way in which the sub-issues are actually broken down for purposes of discussion with regard to the arbitration, I can address the motion to reconsider as well. The parties began this process with seven issues, and we're down to one at this point. It's a difficult one, but a very critical one, because it's the reciprocal compensation rate, and it's one that has a tremendous impact on all of the parties involved in this proceeding. When the commission originally remanded this matter for the production of further evidence as well as the modification of the flex studies that had previously been presented, they essentially issued three directives to the petitioners. The first was to rerun the FLEC model using the rate equivalency method. The second was to reforecast or forecast demand as it related to voice traffic for the future. And the third was to remove certain non-usage sensitive switching costs. The third issue, sub-issue, is frankly the easiest to address and the easiest to dispense with. The Commission's directive required the petitioners to move what it considered to be non-usage sensitive costs, specifically those costs associated with Web Self-Care, Centrex, and Kalea. Mr. Weber, Nathan Weber, who presented expert testimony in both of the hearings, was the one responsible for itemizing those costs. Removing those costs from the total and switching investment included in the FLEC study and provided that information to Mr. Eklund, who actually performed the FLEC study. As evidenced at the time of the hearing, he specifically indicated which costs were associated with what non-usage sensitive component, removed those, and then reran the switching rate, which was presented at the time of the hearing. I'll try to stay away from numbers for the sake of avoiding confidential information so we can stay on the web. But I would indicate that those numbers, the switching rates, are included in not only the testimony, the hearing transcript, but also the petitioner's post-hearing briefs if the commissioners have any questions about what the resulting switching rate was. Now, at the same time, Altel also raised not only its motion to reconsider, but also at the hearing, indicated that the petitioners had presented new evidence which necessitated a re-review of the Commission's previous findings of fact and conclusions of law that were issued in February of 2009. And I think those were specifically enumerated as findings of facts 16 through 20. And at that time, what the Commission had indicated was that the petitioners' switching costs, with the exception of the Web Self-Care, the Centrex, and Kalea, were properly includable as costs for purposes of the FLEX study. And the Commission made that decision because, in fact, it determined that the biggest component cost, the switch processor cost, was in fact usage sensitive. And it also looked not only to the Telecom Act and the applicable law in that regard, but also some of the case law that has been enumerated in this particular area. And what that indicates is that switching costs are recoverable on both a flat charge basis as well as a sensitive per minute charge. At the time of the hearing in this particular matter, there was testimony from both Mr. Weber and Mr. Eklund that nothing has changed in regard to the inclusion of the switch processor costs and the fact that those still are properly includable. And to that end, the testimony is that the switch processor is a shared cost. It is a necessary component for not only the petitioner's calls to petitioners, customers, excuse me, to make and terminate calls, but also for Altel's customers to do the same. And if one tries to carve out specific costs associated with that switch processor, it's just not a realistic equation by any stretch of the imagination, because what you're left with is trying to account for a portion of the switch processor in the future, which certainly isn't going to be adequate to accommodate demand at this point in time. And the one thing that the FCC has made clear is that switching costs, which are a
product of a shared relationship should be shared between all parties who benefit from the switch processor, and there's no question but that is the case here. In order for a party to be successful on a motion for reconsideration, that party has to show that there is a sufficient reason to allow for rehearing, to allow for reconsideration, and to ultimately change that decision. And I would submit to the commissioners that based on the testimony and the evidence that was presented at the first hearing in July of 2008, as well as the second hearing in August of 2009, there's been no change. The testimony remains the same, that the switch processor is a shared cost, that the costs associated with that shall be shared between the parties, and that those costs can be recovered on either a flat rate basis or a per minute basis. And that's what this commission held at that time, and I see no sufficient reason advanced by Altel at this juncture that would require this commission in any way to revisit its previous findings of fact and conclusions of law and to essentially change its mind. And I would submit that to do so under the circumstances as alleged by Altel would actually amount to what would be an arbitrary and capricious decision. With regard to the first sub-issue that I referenced, the rate equivalency method, that was the method that was utilized in the rerun of the petitioner's flex studies, and it was one which the commission directed because it believed that it would result in an overall better allocation of costs. What I think is notable at this point is that Altel doesn't disagree with the application of the rate equivalency method, to the DS3, the DS1, or the DS0 special circuit, but where it draws a distinction is between the DS0 voice circuit and the DS0 special circuit, claiming that one costs more than the other. I would submit to this commission that that's a distinction that need not be drawn and a distinction that's not appropriate, because ultimately what we are looking at here is the rate equivalency method and the weighting process that it performs in order to ensure that there is that better allocation of costs between voice and switch services. And the rate equivalency method does not differentiate between the services, it differentiates between the capacity of the circuits. And while a DS0 voice circuit and a DS0 special circuit may have different services associated with them, the capacity remains the same. And what the rate equivalency method does is it treats a DS0 as a DS0 as a DS0. And that's the appropriate way in order to ensure that the proper weighting is given to the circuits at issue. That's the more theoretical argument. If you look at the more technical argument, then I would ask the commission to look at the testimony offered by Nathan Weber as it relates to the circuit conditioning that needs to be done in order to make sure that all of those circuits ultimately interface to the switch, which is at the DS1 level, if the commissioners recall that testimony from the time of the hearing. And in his testimony, what Mr. Weber did was to demonstrate that Altel's assertion that one circuit costs seven times that of the other simply doesn't make sense in the grand scheme of things. And again, if the purpose of the rate equivalency method, and it is the purpose, to make sure that you treat all circuits the same and accord the proper weighting, Altel hasn't advanced something which essentially gets it to its burden of proving that those should be treated differently. And Mr. Weber's testimony not only explains that, but points out the specific mathematical differences in the costs associated with that such that it does not give Altel's argument the weight which Altel believes it does. I think the most difficult issue that's left before this commission is that of the second sub-issue, and that was reforecasting future demand as it relates not only to what demand for voice traffic and special access will look like in the future, but also how that relates to the ultimate transport systems that have been proposed by the petitioners in their FLEX studies. In their revised studies, The petitioners projected demand through the end of 2010. And so what they did was they looked at available data that they had from 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007, forecasted demand from 2006 to 2010. There have been complaints that that's not an adequate forecast period. However, I would submit to the commissioners that the standard advocated by the FCC is one of reasonableness. And under the circumstances of this particular case, when one looks at how long it's been in progress since 2006, that is a five-year period, and it is one that's reasonable because it is something that gives us a level of certainty with regard to the data, the minute of use data, that we had available. And it also enabled us to project out through 2010 with a level of certainty that allows us a level of confidence in ultimately what that forecasted result was. And to forecast demand through 2012, through 2015, through 2020, or even through the life of the equipment, as Altel suggested, when we know that we are in an environment where voice demand is declining, it makes it exceedingly difficult to forecast future usage for non-voice applications with a high degree of certainty. Because we know they're declining, we don't know what that trend will look like in the future, we don't know what the trend for special services will look like in the future. I think if I were to ask everyone in this room right now what their forecast would be for demand in 2012, 2015, or 2020, I think I would get a number of different answers. And to that end, that's why the petitioners did what they did. They took the data points that they had available, they looked at the numbers that they had, and they made the best forecast that they possibly could, because that's the one that would be supported by the most sufficient indicia of reliability for this particular case. Now, what the commission also did at the time that it directed the petitioners to reforecast demand was to also indicate that we needed to take a look at that transport system. And the commissioners petitioners reran the FLEX studies in this particular case using both an OC-192 transport system as well as an OC-48 transport system. Based upon the current need of these particular petitioners, as well as essentially, the marketplace in which they're operating and the advancement of technology, the petitioners submitted that FLEX study using an OC-192 with confidence that that was what they needed. However, we did listen to the Commission's concerns with regard to reconciling future demand with the transport system and the associated costs, and submitted the FLEX study also with an OC-48. That use of the OC-48, use of the 2010 forecast, essentially allows for use of the OC-48 through that time period. We know from the testimony offered by Mr. Weber, by Mr. Eklund, and even some of the admissions by Altel's expert witness, Mr. Craig Conwell, that use of anything less than an OC-48 for these particular companies is unacceptable, and to suggest otherwise doesn't comport with the FCC's rules and with the case law that's out there that indicates that companies should be using the most efficient technology available, and that which essentially allows for these companies to meet their current demand. As evidenced by the record in this case, all of these companies either have or are in the process of putting in an OC-192 transport system. And while we obviously can't ignore the fact that there is declining demand in the future, we also can't put in a network which for the future which is smaller than that which they need to satisfy their current demand today. And so that's essentially what we tried to do in forecasting through 2010 and bringing in that OC-48 transport system, because I would suggest that that essentially reconciles the two concerns that this commission had, was forecasting the demand with that degree of reasonableness, with that degree of certainty and confidence, but also making sure that if there were concerns about the OC-192 simply being too big or having too much capacity for the future, that 48 is smaller than what they currently have, and is certainly what they need to satisfy their current demand for both voice and switch services. And ultimately, when one looks at the entirety of this process, the hallmark of it is reasonableness. When one reads the FCC's rules in Section 251 of the Act, when one looks at the case law that's out there, which I will freely admit is slim, to say the least, one does come away with the fact that you are to use reasonable costs, reasonable forecast periods, ultimately to arrive at a reasonable rate. And that's what the petitioners did in this particular case. It's much easier, as most people know, to build up a model, to build up an argument, than it is to attack it, and than it is to tear it down. And I think the perspective that the commission needs to look at or needs to use when looking at the petitioner's FLEC models in this particular case is that while Altel has made suggestions that perhaps this is better or perhaps we look at this fill rate or this capacity issue, that's not the standard that's been offered by the FCC. That's not the framework within which a FLEC model is to be developed. And to move beyond that framework, to move beyond those parameters, to essentially start plugging in things that might sound good from a visceral standpoint, that's essentially when the process isn't followed anymore as far as the guidelines that the FCC has put in place, and that's what ultimately results in what I would submit as an arbitrary and capricious decision. The petitioners have offered FLEC models in this particular case that have been the product of significant work, significant time, significant money and effort, and have done their best to present evidence and testimony that supports those and ultimately shows why the rates, the resulting rates, using either the OC-192 or the OC-48, are in fact supportable. And so we would respectfully request that the commissioners adopt those rates, which have been proposed by the petitioners in this particular case. Did my best to try to limit that because I know we've had these issues in front of us for quite some time, but I'm certainly open to answering any questions at a later time that the commissioners may have. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Mr. Wazor?
Thank you, commissioners, for your time today. This has been a long, long case, and I appreciate that it's taken this commission quite a bit of time, staff's time. It's taken quite a bit of the party's time. And I have personally found this case at times very frustrating. I'm going to address these issues and some of that frustration, but I'm going to address in reverse order from Ms. Moore. So I'm going to take the transport question first. And, you know, best laid plans of mice and men, I've laid out a nice little argument, but my frustration is probably winning me over. I have to submit, I think Mr. Eklund has absolutely zero credibility. You know, Ms. Moore just made this argument that, well, we heard the commission and we lowered our study from our network from 192 to a 48. Well, the interesting aspect of that is they didn't do that until the absolute last round of testimony. And the fascinating thing about it, she just finishes arguing about how well this projection is through 2010. But look at what Eklund does when he lowers the network. He says, okay, well, you know, here Altel's been making this argument that the 192 network is too big given my forecast, so I'll lower it to an OC-48 network. Well, you know what he does with his forecast for his demand? He throws a bunch of it out when he lowers it to a 48. So, I mean, that's just incredulous that he can sit here and say, my forecast through 2010 is good for my OC-192 network. But if I'm going to lower it to an OC-48, I'm going to throw a bunch of the demand out. You know, and the most evident of this is if you look, Kennebec's rate goes up on a smaller network because he throws a bunch of their demand out. I mean, look, either your demand's valid or it's not. You can't adjust these numbers. This has been my frustration with this. Mr. Eklund has played a shell game. He changes numbers. He changes a number over here and says, I've changed a number over here, but then he'll change a number over here so that number doesn't hurt him that he changed it over here when he acknowledges we've made an issue. And that's been something that I have found almost offensive from a standpoint of this commission is trying to make a reasonable, rational decision. You have an expert who's playing these games. Let's look at capacity. On this transport. Now, we kind of use some of these numbers, but we talk about demand and we talk about capacity, but we have to talk about them in some kind of terminology. So generally, we talk about DS1s. Look to the evidence. Over a year ago, I sat in front of this commission, and I looked this commission in the eye. I said, commissioners, you cannot, on this record, give them their transport rate. Why can't you do that? This is what I said a year ago. You can't do it because you have Eklund giving you forecasts that are less than 10% of a network, the size of a network, and then you have their engineer who's daily working with these companies saying, that forecasted demand is inefficient for this size of the network because they've already got a lot more demand than that. I mean, if you look back to your findings and conclusions in this, you stated in finding of fact 22, and I'm looking at the McCook ones, they're one or two off depending on which one you look at. It says the commission finds that McCook witnesses gave differing testimony regarding forward-looking demand. It goes on and talks about Mr. Eklund. And then it says, Nathan Weber testified the OC-192 network was needed to meet future demand. He stated that if a smaller network, such as an OC-12 or OC-48, were deployed, it's highly likely capacity the systems would be exhausted well within the 7 to 10 years life of the deployment. And then the commission then in the next finding concludes, the commission finds the record does not contain a credible projection of forward-looking demand and the use of a 2006 demand is inconsistent with the proposed use of the OC-192 network. So how does Eklund respond to this in his initial rounds of testimony? He says, you just need me to project it to 2010, but I can totally disregard the size of the network again. So we come all the way back to hearing on this transport. So what's the testimony at the hearing? Ms. Moore solicits from Mr. Weber himself that way before the useful life of this equipment is over, you're going to be exceeding an OC-48 in demand. Mr. Rizzold asked Mr. Eklund, why wouldn't you talk to the engineer that's working with these companies when you're determining demand? Oh, I just don't. So this commission's stuck where we were a year ago on this transport demand question. They are giving you a network size, an OC-192, without appropriate demand to justify or make it even efficient. Their witnesses are in conflict still. Their testimony on these basic issues has not changed in the last year. Now, whether it was a recognition by Eklund to throw something in at the end and try to throw the 48, but then he lowers his demand. I mean, he throws out demand he had used on an OC-192 study. I think this commission is faced on this transport issue with the exact same question it had a year ago, that these witnesses cannot be reconciled. Now, Ms. Moore attacks our fill rate, attacks our projections as being unreasonable. I provided you case law and uni cases where courts have upheld standard fill rates where commissions have said, look, you can't say a system's efficient unless you meet these projected demand rates. Conwell provided an analysis under which he could do a reasonable fill rate. It's attached to his Altel's Exhibit 20, where he mapped out, and I mean, his fill rates are not outrageous. I mean, he's using like a 40% utilization rate several years out, and he's weighting that, and he does his entire analysis. He's trying to be reasonable. Let's look. If we're going to build these networks, then we have to divide this over demand. This has been... frankly, I think this is the only thing the commission can decide at this time. You cannot use this conflict of their testimony. You cannot use Mr. Eklund's OC 48 analysis when he throws out the man he used 2 months before to do the OC 192 analysis. This type of activity, this purposeful playing with the numbers just to try to push his rates up, I think should be rejected by the commission. I think the commission should state, look, if you're going to need an OC 192 network, fine, but you need to show the demand for it. And I want this commission to understand that we've been accused, Altel's been accused of, well, we want this commission to just come up with a voice network, or we're against the ILEC's rollout broadband. You know, Altel doesn't care. Look, roll out the broadband. Altel isn't asking this commission to come up with a voice network. What Altel is saying is you have to project all this broadband demand that justifies this big network so we can divide the cost fairly. What Altel doesn't want to do is they don't want to pay to subsidize the broadband. That's the question. So if you're going to need an OC 192 for your broadband needs, God bless you. But I shouldn't have to pay for it on my voice network. All that examination about what could be satisfied, it went to the demand that they were projecting. If an OC-12 can satisfy, an OC-3 can satisfy all the demand he's projecting, Eklund himself has said, then it's inefficient to use something bigger. So if their demand, which falls, there is Eklund's projected demand is all in single digits for all these companies in comparison to the capacity that an OC-192 network offers. Single digits. And that's what they're asking you to divide that cost over. Eklund's testimony then becomes in conflict with Weber, because Weber says, hey, that makes that OC-192 inefficient. Now, when you go to the OC-190, the OC-48, guess what happens? Demand stays in single digits because, at least for three of these companies, because Eklund throws out that demand. So you have to size demand to make the network that you're dividing the cost over efficient. Weber says these companies are all going to exceed demands for an OC-48 or maybe already have. That demand needs to be included. Conwell provides a rational way for this commission to do that. Eklund doesn't. And Eklund's numbers can't be used on this record. My frustrations, I'm sorry. They try to teach you in law school, you know, not to be emotional, but I talk to my kids. My wife tries to teach me that too. So I like to talk about this demand on this rate equivalency. And there's two places I think this commission should look. And these issues over and over, and we've thrashed these issues around. But I think there's a couple spots, if I can find my notes here, where I think the commission needs to look. Eklund, when he's talking about his establishing his rate equivalency, and I have this quote on page 15 of my reply brief from his pre-filed testimony when he's explaining rate equivalencies using the UDET rates. He says, a CLEC can purchase a DS0 unbundled dedicated interoffice transport circuit or a DS1 from Qwest. CLEC can use the UDET to transport voice traffic between central offices through the CLEC, although the CLEC can purchase a DS1 UDET and put 24 times the amount of voice traffic over the transport route using a DS1 than using a DSO. And the DS1 only costs the CLEC 3.4 times more than the DSO. Now, why does Altel, and as Conwell was, straightforward as this commission, look, we disagree on one issue on this rate equivalency, and that is when voice traffic to be considered bundle load, just how the switch does it, so you consider it a DS1, or is it supposed to be treated like a DS0 special circuit? So why is Eklund's quote important? This commission on reasonable doesn't throw out common sense. If I have 1,000 voice trunks, and now let's talk about how they come up with these numbers, and perhaps I think I used 300 as an example in my brief. How do we come up with we need that many voice trunks? Weber testifies, the way I do that is I look at how many end users I have. I figure for every 5 end users, I need a voice trunk. And then I figure out, and then I get a voice trunk number, and I divide that by 24 so I can figure out how many DS1s I need for transport. And that's the practical way of why those should be counted that way, because that's the way they're on the transport network. Switch combines them. If this commission has me paying for the switch, I'm paying to combine DS0, these lines coming in from the houses, at the switch, and they're hitting the network at the DS1 level. Not the DS, so they're not special circuits. And that's what a carrier does. I mean, you combined those voice trunks onto a DS1 because that's where your cost efficiency is. I mean, if it makes the network has to be efficient, and I think then it became telling in the hearing when Weber came up with this, oh, well, you know, this interface system, maybe you have to do a special interface. I ask him, do any of these companies do that? I don't know of any events. Do any of these companies in your network design, did you design any of these special interfaces where they'd have to use these DSOs? No, I didn't. Commissioner's analysis asked him, does this occur? And he says, maybe 10% of the time on the DS1s. So this extra cost he tried to come up with to try to divert this argument away from DS1s doesn't exist. Doesn't exist in an efficient network. So this is the practical way that you transport voice traffic, and that is on the DS1s. And that's all we're doing. I mean, we're not getting a special circuit that's open to us all the time. It's more of a transiting or EAS-type deal where we're just borrowing a portion of that line for a second, for a couple minutes. Those are all combined on those DS1s, and I think that conversion makes the perfect sense. The other thing that I have the commission should look at in answering that is look at how the ILEX treated toll traffic and EAS traffic. They didn't count those as trunks. They didn't count those. They didn't say those were equivalent to DSOs. They counted those at the DS1 level. So if you got this toll traffic all coming into your switch at DS1 level, if you got 24 capacity of 24 DSOs on one DS1, they counted that as one. Well, what's the difference? There isn't any. You got the same capacity coming in here, and the only difference is they want to count voice trunks at this abnormally high rate inefficiently just to jack up the rate. But imagine you're a CLEC and you go in and you want to buy, and you have 300 lines in the community. You're not going to buy 300 DSOs. You're going to buy, let me do my math here quick, 24, 8. Commissioner Hans is usually my guy that does the math for me. 13 DS1s would cover that. That's how you transport on the transport network. You don't, the interesting thing is you don't see these ILEX laying out a bunch of DSOs to transport voice traffic. What they do is they put it on as DS1. That's what the switch efficiency is designed for. And one place, if you look at Conwell's July 3rd testimony on page 28, he includes a sheet from McCook. And that sheet shows, this was a sheet that was produced during discovery. It shows the toll trunks, and then it shows how many existing DS1s you have to carry those toll trunks. And then if you go back and look the way Eklund counted those toll trunks, he counted them at the DS1 level. So I submit to this commission, those things, if you're bundling toll trunks and you get to count them as a bundle, you're bundling voice lines, you should count them as a bundle also. Count them at the DS1 level. There's also the outside plant issue, and we've talked about that. Ms. Moore didn't directly talk about the outside transport. Again, there we are looking at issues. If you would properly project demand, you would actually fill that fiber. I mean, we're looking at dark fiber, outside plant, that has, out of 48 lines, has 3 or 4 lines in use in their study. But if you would include this projected demand that they say is necessary, you'd see that dark fiber number go up. Conwell recommended setting that at 50% rate. That gives you a dark fiber for every fiber in use. So that outside plant fiber with the extra demand should see extra usage. Now, I'm going to talk briefly about the switching issue. You know, commissioners, Ms. Moore is right on the standard. It's a higher standard for me to meet asking for the reconsideration. The commission ruled on this. I want to point out a couple things that I think are wrong with what she said, though. The commission didn't set a flat rate. Commission could set a flat rate basis, potentially. Commission set a per-minute use rate. And for that switching cost for a per-minute use rate, I think it's clear that these are constant, given that I'm trying to stay away from the confidential numbers, but given that you saw a sizable decrease in the forecast minutes of use, you saw no change in those switching costs. While the commission at finding of fact 17, again in McCook, references that 47 CFR 51509 contemplates switching costs may be recovered through a permanent usage charge. I certainly agree with that, but that's what it says. But that permanent usage charge is subject to showing cost sensitivity under the other regs, and that clearly there's no cost sensitivity based on the additional evidence they provided showing a markedly increase up to a third decrease, a third decrease in minutes of use with no corresponding loss and cost. For a quick outline for the issues that Altel believes, I'd again refer the commission to Exhibit 20. It walks you through each issue. I think it provides a levelized demand that's reasonable, supportable, and supportable on appeal given this record and given the record that you have this internal conflict between the ILEC witnesses. On the DS1 issue, on the rate equivalency, I think the record's clear that those voice trunks should be counted at the DS1 level as 24-1 because the switch does that combining. And if the commission determines that there's a switch cost there, then essentially you're ending up that Altel's getting hit for the combining the cost of the switch processor that combines those calls, getting hit for that. And then under Mr. Weber's testimony, we're getting hit for this inefficiency of this channel bank, which it replaces essentially the switch processor. And then finally under this, the outside plant, we believe a fill rate of 50% is reasonable and supported by case law. And then on the switching, we'd ask the commission to reconsider the usage-sensitive question on the switching and determine that the switch cost, and the commission needs to remember that Altel didn't take the position that all costs related to the switch were non-usage sensitive. Mr. Conwell in the first rounds did say that there are certain things were usage sensitive, but that the remaining costs as articulated in the original hearing were not usage sensitive and should be disallowed given the new evidence. So with that rant, I'm done and if the commission has questions or just I like the fact that you felt you had to release everybody before they had to listen to me. So, but if you feel compelled to listen to me some more, I'm more than willing to talk some more.
Thanks, Mr. Wazorek. Staff, comments?
At this time, I guess staff's only comment would be on the motion to reconsider the with the oral argument, there's some to ponder. I hate to just make a recommendation from the hip. I'm not comfortable doing that. On Altel's motion to reconsider, I guess what staff looked at was that pursuant to ARSD 2010-01-3001, the order came out in February, and really that's when he should have asked for reconsideration. He had 30 days at that point to ask for reconsideration. So I think he's untimely with his motion to reconsider. Obviously, you have an order yet to be determined or, you know, yet to be issued, and he could ask for any reconsideration on that one at that point if he would still feel the need. So that would be staff's recommendation solely on the motion to reconsider. The other thing I guess you could look at is this new evidence. I'm not sure what the tipping point is here on the new evidence. I mean, all along everybody, and they've testified, and that's no news, that there's declining minutes and declining demand. So there was nothing new about that came out of the evidence in August or September, whenever we held that last hearing. What was surprising, and I don't know if that tips it over into the new evidence category, is that there wasn't a lowering of the cost. And so that was a surprising result of that flex study, but I don't know that necessarily it sure seemed to be new evidence. But I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, that is clearly up to you and your advisors if you want to consider that as enough to look at this as a new evidentiary matter and open it up for reconsideration. Although staff still firmly believes that he was too late in asking for the motion to reconsider, that it was untimely.
Mr. Chairman, can I just address the staff's point on that?
Again, we've got a couple of movements here. So normally we'd give rebuttal, which I'm somewhat reticent to do, but if we'll give you each one opportunity in just a couple of minutes to make any comments you think the commission needs to consider. We'll start with Ms. Moore, and then Mr. Resort will take you.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, for purposes of clarification, are you seeking comment in regard to the oral argument as a whole or Ms. Kramer's comments?
Well, you can certainly address both, but my intention was the oral arguments and Moss.
Thank you. And I will try to be brief because I, too, appreciate that this has gone on for quite some time. What I would suggest to the commission is that with regard to the continued claim that the witness's testimony is inconsistent, that you need to look at the testimony yourselves. Because what they also teach us in law school is to obviously advocate passionately for our clients, but at the same time not to spin the facts or the evidence. And I would suggest that the testimony speaks for itself, and the testimony also comports with the reality of the situation, and that there is, in fact, declining demand. That is something that the petitioners have attempted to account for and have accounted for in the revised flex studies, and moreover that they have shown, and that Mr. Conwell has in fact admitted, that anything less than an OC 48 is inappropriate. And when one goes back and one looks at the duration of this particular contract, which was from January 1, 2007, through the conclusion of 2009, which is rapidly approaching, and one looks at the forecast of demand, that's what's consistent. To forecast for more than that simply isn't going to accord any level of confidence to any segment of this particular process, because we can only forecast based on what we know. We look at the historical demand when it comes to voice data. We look at the trends that are evidenced in that. But you look at forecasting for special circuits in the future, we're talking about services for which there is no historical demand, services for for which they either haven't been placed on these networks yet, they may be placed in the future, and so to somehow try to account for that, frankly, is absolute, complete, and total guesswork. And that's not what the FCC intended. And that's why what the petitioners did in this particular case was to use the 48, which, according to the testimony, the useful life of which will be exhausted by the end of 2010. And to put in anything less than that doesn't comport with reality. That's what the engineer says. What we have here in this particular case are two individuals, Mr. Weber and Mr. Ackland, who are engineers and numbers guys. They don't have any incentive to game the numbers, to try to jack the numbers up, to try to do anything along those lines, because they work with these companies on a day-to-day basis, on a year-to-year basis. And while some might suggest that inflects some bias into the process, what it does is it actually educates them better. And what's being suggested is that Mr. Conwell, who isn't an engineer, who doesn't have the background, who doesn't have the requisite knowledge of these companies that the expert witnesses for the petitioners do, is that somehow his testimony should be elevated as paramount because reality sometimes presents us with tricky situations, which not all of the rules are always designed to encounter. And I think what is most significant here with regard to the rate equivalency method, which I'll mention briefly, is that this is the first time Altel has raised the argument with regard to the treatment of the DS0 voice circuit versus the DS0 special circuit. If you recall, the rate equivalency method was first used in a proceeding before the Nebraska Public Service Commission. Altel, and it was the Great Plains Communications, was the LEC, and Western Wireless, Altel's predecessor, lost. Actually, they won before the arbitrator because the commission used a separate arbitrating body. The commission reversed. Then Altel lost at the federal court level as well as at the Eighth Circuit level. And at no point during that time was the treatment of the DS0 voice versus special circuit ever raised. I think that's telling because ultimately what that differentiation in treatment does is it enables Altel to effectively backdoor the issue of reopening the bandwidth method. And the point that I'll leave you with is when you go back through the record and you go back through the evidence, what you'll notice is that Altel's proposed rates this time are lower than what they were the first time. And so I would submit to you that while Altel's correct, it doesn't have to pay more than its fair share of the costs, it still has to pay its share of the costs. And what those rates demonstrate to me is that Altel is the one that ultimately has the motive not to use the methods used by the petitioner because it results in a rate which it simply doesn't want to pay. And to now, after all of this time, when the point of the commissioner's remand was to better allocate costs, to ultimately end up with an even lower rate than what they advanced the first time simply isn't genuine. Thank you.
Mr. Wazorek.
Just a couple points. First, on that Nebraska deal, that was Western Wireless, which, yes, Altel acquired. But I think to try to say, I mean, if you read the case law, I wasn't involved in the hearing. If you read the case law, that issue was not examined by the courts, and I think it appears their question there was more of wholesale versus retail questions, what was the best. I can't say whether or not the argument as to how to allocate that came up. But I don't see how that's, number one, I don't see that there's any authority on that. Number one, I don't see how it's any binding, and I don't see how it can bind Altel's arguments in this proceeding, given it's made by a company that it acquired after the case was even heard. So I think that's disingenuous to make an argument that somehow a company that you acquire, that you inherit those arguments for the rest of your life. Just one short thing on the cost. I mean, look, if you look, you essentially have, they would have this commission make voice traffic pay 80% of all transport costs, 80%. Yet they agree voice traffic needs this bike path, but they need to build the superhighway for what's coming. So they want voice traffic to pay 80% of the superhighway. I mean, that's where I just look at this and go, it doesn't make any sense. You got to project some of that superhighway demand when you're projecting, allocating those costs. I'm not sure that there was any testimony that the OC 48 would be exhausted by the end of next year. Obviously, given the projections of the demand, it sure won't be. I mean, the projections of the demand are single digits next year, so I don't know how you turn that into an OC 48's exhausted by the end of next year. I think that gets into this, gets right back to where we were a year ago. Weber certainly testifies the OC 48's exhausted, but Eklund sure isn't forecasting demand that proves that. On staff's question, I appreciate staff on the 30 days, but I think the difficulty becomes with that rule is, number one, the administrative rule she cites is, that rule, as I read it, is for a final decision. These decisions are not final. And even if it were for an interim decision, a court or the council or commission always has the ability, why a case is still before them, to go back and revisit any decision if they think there's been new evidence on it. I do appreciate the staff saying, point to saying, well, I agree that everybody kept saying, you know, or Eklund kept saying, these numbers are trending down, minutes of use are trending down, but he's also saying the switch was usage sensitive, and when you see a 30% drop in minutes of use and see no adjustment in cost, I think that's pretty telling new evidence on it. As I read the rules, though, is I could make a motion for reconsideration from 30 days from a final decision on all issues, not just interim decisions. I think the commission also has the ability under new evidence to open the record up. You know, courts have the ability under new evidence to open the record up as long as a year after the case is even completed. So I think there's plenty of ability for the commission to revisit those issues while the case is still pending.
Thanks, Mr. Wazorek. Questions of commissioners or advisors? I've got a couple for Ms. Moore. You know, Ms. Moore, you sort of implied that maybe Mr. Wazorek was spinning some conflict between Weber and Eklund, and I guess maybe I'm in danger of being spun, but, I mean, I heard that testimony, and I've read it a couple of times since, and I still find myself nagged by this feeling that they are not in alignment. Where am I wrong?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, what we're looking at there is that's the reality of the situation, and that's the reality in which both of these gentlemen are performing their specific tasks as it related to this flex study. Mr. Weber is the one who is engineering the networks for these petitioners, and he's doing so with both the voice side of things and the special services side of things in mind. And while Altel has indicated that they're not advocating for designing two separate networks, that's the ultimate effect of the argument. And to that end, what Mr. Weber is telling you is this is what these companies need now in order to satisfy all demand. And it makes no sense to try to simply isolate voice demand when it comes to actually putting these networks in place. Because what you have here is a network that can't simply carry voice demand. It has to carry all the services. You can't parse it out, so to speak. And when you look at Mr. Eklund's testimony, he readily admits that he struggles with that. He readily admits that he talked with Mr. Weber. And what he is looking at, to a certain extent, is that decline in voice demand. And what he is saying is, okay, I have Mr. Weber telling me that an OC-192 is what's necessary for these companies to satisfy demand which they'll achieve in the future. And it doesn't make any sense for them to invest in a smaller network than what they currently need, even though we know there's declining demand. But what we have here is Mr. Weber saying, we're going to use the most efficient technology, we're going to look at that, and all you need to do is in order to fully utilize an OC-192 is to have 25% capacity. And so if there are concerns about the 192, you look to the 48. And there is testimony in the record which indicates the useful life of that OC-48 will be exhausted by 2010 for purposes of carrying both voice and special services. And when you look at that, you can see that ultimately what the petitioners have tried to do is bring that demand in line with the equipment. And I think the other thing that you need to look at, Commissioner, is not just the testimony with regard to the demand and the transport system, but the costs that are associated with that. It has to be looked at from a global perspective, because if we get too locked up in the minutia, I understand the concern that you're having. But when one actually looks at the costs, there isn't the linear effect that Mr. Conwell would have you believe there is. There is, I believe, an 11% savings between the use of an OC-192 and an OC-48 network, and that's primarily because there are some different cards used in there, and there's a 1% difference in costs between an OC-48 network and an OC-12 network. And if you're looking at the FCC's framework and you're using a reasonable measuring period, and there are cases in the petitioner's post-hearing briefs on how tough it is to actually forecast demand and some of the problems that they've had over the years, if you're looking at that reasonable measuring period, you're looking at the most efficient technology, and you have testimony that's telling you that he's 90%, he hasn't put in an OC-12 in 10 years, and he's building networks that are greater than an OC-192, even though there may be that perceived disconnect versus looking at the voice arena over here and looking at the switched arena over here, they come together because we're using efficient technology, we're looking at costs, and we're looking at a reasonable measuring period where we can define with some certainty what the voice demand is and what special service demand is.
But Ms. Moore, doesn't that show the total weakness of the forecast we have on the record? I mean, if all of these consultants are saying, we would never put in a 12, we haven't done that in a decade. You know, a 992 is the only thing we do. And yet our record doesn't have any firm forecast that indicates that's what a reasonable person would do. I'm sure Mr. Weber's reasonable. I'm sure all his colleagues are reasonable. So why is the record so totally inadequate to support these very smart professional engineers?
I don't think it is inadequate, because what you're looking at is you're looking at what the companies are currently using. You're looking at the equipment that's out there. You're looking at engineers who are testifying as to what they do. And you're looking at numbers guys such as Mr. Eklund, who are looking at the trends that he can see from the data. And I'll freely admit, you do get into a little bit of an esoteric process here, but there isn't a better method that's been defined by the FCC's rules. There isn't a concrete formula that's there. There are guidelines. And so what one has to be instructed by is day-to-day practical experience in looking at what these companies need and looking at what they install. And I think what we're trying to inject into this process is an element of certainty that's never going to be there. Part of that is because of the change in climate, because you look back at when the act was drafted in 1996, it was a voice environment. That's changed, but the rules haven't changed.
When we started this process, Ms. Moore, your clients were comfortable using consultants that made a five-year projection. But you know, today in your argument, you say, you know, geez, looking at 2012, that's just too far out. We don't have enough certainty there. I mean, you know, on the commission remand, I mean, there were numbers rerun. I mean, is there a reason that 5 or 6 year projections made sense when we started this process, but that even a 3 year projection now is just not the kind of thing that can reasonably be put into the record?
Well, and what I would submit, Mr. Chairman, is that when we started this process, what the petitioners did was they used 2006 demand to represent the future forecast and future demand, because that's what was certain. And because we knew demand was declining, we thought there were uncertainties there. So the five-year projection is what accompanied the reruns. What there was the first time was use of the 2006 demand. And as I understood the commission's directive, it was to actually forecast demand into the future. So what we did was we used the data points that we had to project out the 5 years, because that's what we had for purposes of looking at the minute demand. And that's what we were able to do with comfort with regard to special access demand.
It just seems to me that I do have a level of nervousness when we've got very smart companies making multi-million-dollar investments in networks that we've been told last 10 years. They've got confidence in making those investments. I presume because they have forecasts that indicate those investments will give them a reasonable return, or at least meet their needs. And yet we're also hearing that, we just don't have any confidence in forecasts going out that far. But they're making decisions every day based on forecasts that obviously we don't have. Nobody's given us those forecasts, but they must exist. Where am I misunderstanding the gap here?
I think it's the distinction between the voice world and the special service world, because they know for a fact that special services, broadband, all of those sorts of things are where things are going in the future. And that's what's necessary in order to – that's what's driving the demand. And I think that the testimony certainly supports that. Mr. Weber indicated as such. Mr. Eklund indicated as such, that voice demand is not what's driving the need for larger networks and for greater capacity.
So if we all agree that it is, you know, special services that are driving the demand for a 192 or even for a 48 – does Mr. Wieczorek's concern that we're pushing too much of the cost onto voice, I mean, does that have validity?
No, because that's the purpose of the allocation process. That's the purpose of the rate equivalency method in making sure that costs are appropriately allocated between voice and special services. And when you look back at Mr. Eklund's testimony, he talks about fibers, dark fibers, portions that are carved out for purposes of special services. So we can talk all we want about voice demand, declining demand, costs associated with that. But the second that we start looking at that, then we realize there has to be an allocation process to make sure that voice isn't carrying too much of that cost. And I think what's instructive to remember, too, is if you go back to the 2008 hearing and there were questions about, well, what's going to happen if voice demand declines, the rate's going to go up. Those costs have to go somewhere. And correct, you absolutely can't have Altel and other wireless carriers supporting all of those costs. But at the same time, you still have to have people paying their fair share of those costs because they ultimately still need the network. And that's why you look to the allocation process in order to ensure that what questions you may have about costs being too high are taken care of and are carved out appropriately.
Great. Thanks, Ms. Moore. Other questions, commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree that the 30-day the timeliness issue is irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. The PUC can on its own the commission can on its own motion decide to whether to pursue this or not, and I really think that it's important for us to get this right as opposed to constrict ourselves in that fashion. The Nebraska issue I don't think is relevant for us to consider either because it's Nebraska for no other reason, and it's not something that we've had an opportunity to spend a lot of time on at this point. We haven't reviewed it. It's new to the argument here, so I'm not giving that credibility to this point. My challenge, Mr. Chairman, is that, again, back to where we were previously, there's a lot of contradiction in the information that we're giving here, being given here. Unfortunately, we don't have the crystal ball and have to make our decision based on the evidence that's presented to us. And I'm still troubled by the fact that Weber and Eklund testimony is contradicts itself. I expressed that the last time, and I'm still struggling very, very much with that. I'm very tempted to take the information under advisement and spend more time with this. It seems we have spent so much time on it already, although trying to balance the oral arguments with previous testimony is a bit of a challenge, at least for me. I thought previously that Altel was using a 28-to-1 ratio, and I heard a 24-to-1 ratio in the discussion here today. I'm wondering did I hear correctly, or am I remembering inaccurate? It seems like previously you were talking 28-to-1.
I think where the confusion comes in is I think there's agreement that the DS1 has 24 times the capacity of a DSO, but I think it's a DS3 has 28 times the capacity of a DS1.
A voice path is generally a DSO.
A voice path, as Mr. Eklund testified, you could carry the capacity for 24 voice paths on a DS-1, or if you had you could have a DSO carry one voice. If you have a kind of special circuit or I think that's the consistent testimony.
Okay. The a broadband path, though, is generally a DS-1, correct?
I'm not a technical guy, but I think you can do certain broadband applications over a DSO. But I think most of the time when they talked about a DSO, they talked about that being a special, like a private line special circuit. I think broadband, when you get large broadband applications, I think everybody kind of talked about that your demands tended to be DS-3s and DS-1s.
I'm trying to remember from previous testimony. I probably shouldn't bring that in at this point. Can you help me with, would you agree or disagree that an OC-12 used in 1997 that had to be replaced by an OC-48 in 2001, and in 2008 an OC-192 is deemed necessary, that in 10 more years a usage should not be down to an OC-48 or less than an OC-48?
Hey, I want to make this clear, Commissioner, and I tried to make it clearer in my arguments, is that, look.
Well, you have to make it abundantly clear.
Well, and I'll try to make it. I think the one thing the Commission has to look at is if they want to go out and build and gold plate their network and overbuild their network, that's within their power. When you come in and do a FLEC analysis, you're not telling them that that's all they can build. They can build whatever they want within whatever their rules are. Where Alltel's issue falls in is, look, build out your broadband, offer TV services, do all that, but you have to project demand by it. So I'm not sitting here saying, when my cross-examination on Weber is, look, all the demand Eklund is forecasting can be satisfied by an OC-12 or an OC-3. I'm not saying that is the reality in the world. What I'm saying is the rules require you to have an efficient network for the demand forecast. So either show me where the demand is, show me where the demand is, or you have to up your demand. For example, there was this comment that an OC-48 is going to be exhausted at the end of 2010. Well, for one of these companies, they only show the use of a couple hundred DS-1s in capacity in their forecast. Well, an OC-48 has over 1,300 DS-1s. So, you know what? Add in those extra DS-1s when we're forecasting these costs. That's fine. You can't, and that's that conflict that I see between Weber and Eklund is Eklund comes in and says, these guys are already exceeding this or right at this level in OC-48. He's out there day to day. I'm not going to say that they're not there. What I'm saying is it's not in your forecast. It's not in the denominator. You're not dividing over that demand, that cost over that demand. So I'm not advocating that, yes, make these guys install an OC-3. What I'm advocating is, hey, if they need an OC-192, then you have to use a justifiable demand. And Weber himself testified that a network's inefficient unless you're going to exceed the capacity of the lower network. So when this is off the top of my head, I speak in generalities, but as I recall, when Eklund redid his demand to justify the 48, is he still was only projecting you have to understand the demand that they projected, total demand that they projected. I think for every company went down in April, and then for all but one company went down then when he projected the 48 because he just kept, lowering demand as he lowered the network size. Big deal. You lower the network size, but you cut the demand. So you're dividing over a smaller number. We're not sitting here advocating that you tell these guys. I think when Weber says these guys are at or exceeding the OC-48 kind of capacity level, I think Weber's out there day to day, and I'm not going to challenge him on it. And that would make much more sense to me when he advocates for an OC-192. But when you look at the demand and how the rules read, look, you have a shortcoming here. You have to account for why the demand doesn't reflect the network size. And with your permission, Commissioner, I want to make one point on something Ms. Moore said, it might be that there's some confusion there, but in the record at this last hearing at page 127, I did have a discussion with Eklund about him taking out things, and he did take out, he said, some cable costs, because we were talking about broadband and TV, but he did not carve out future demand. So, like, if I have, let's say, I'm just going to use an example. I have voice takes a DS1 here, and cable or some kind of broadband application takes this cable, is using some kind of lines to do it for TV. He might take that out, but if that's the growth area and this is area shrinking, he didn't take out all that growth. I mean, he provided for the growth in the network, but he didn't take out the growth that's going to be attributable to that. I mean, he left that in. So I think there's a I think if you look back at it, and then also the testimony was that he didn't do that for all companies either. So, you know, this argument that he took some of that cost out, I don't think carries much water. I mean, look at the whole. So I hope I answered your question. I got rambling again.
Well, you're still being passionate.
Yeah.
Ms. Moore, I think Mr. Wieczorek makes excellent points when he states that in Eklund's analysis, when he lowers the network, he reduces the demand as well. It seems really troubling to me. I know you've attempted to explain that. Can you help me get over that hurdle?
Well, some of it is he's taking out the demand associated with transiting circuits. And when we originally looked at our had the first hearing, what we were talking about was the 2006 minutes being reflective of future demand for purposes of dividing costs and using that as the denominator. When we did the 5 years, the transiting circuits and the demand associated therewith was removed. And that was because of Mr. Weber's testimony that when one looks to the future, you're not going to look at transiting circuits as something that's being utilized by these particular companies. Who that reflects the most in this particular arbitration is Kennebec, and I don't think you're going to find that holds up for the other petitioners. But the reason that demand was removed was because what Mr. Weber was saying was that you're not going to find those companies utilizing those sorts of transport networks in the future. They are constructing their own networks, building their own networks such that they're going to be able to handle that for usage. So that's the demand that's being used. So I think to a certain extent there's been a suggestion that somehow there's been this wholesale massive removal in order to jerry-rig the numbers, and I would submit that that's not the case at all, and that if you look at the different methodologies in the FLEX study and you can track what has been removed from the first study to the revised study, you'll see that that actually is the case here. And so ultimately what you're looking at between the OC-192 and the OC-48 and the demand period being 2006 demand in the first FLEX study and the five-year period in the second study would be the removal of those transiting circuits.
Please.
I think this is important. You can look. The transiting circuits are included through his testimony into his last round, which is given on in July 2009, and that's when he takes them out. I mean, but they're in April 2009. But it's only when he lowers the network size does he throw out the transiting. And you might recall during the hearing, I asked him, why did you do that? And he said, well, because Weber says those are going to go away. Well, did he tell you when they're going to go away? No. So he didn't know when they were going to go away, but that's the only place they're not appearing. And if you look at Altel's hearing exhibit 20 on the second page, you can see by Kennebec, actually, the last bar and showing the numbers shows that rate actually went up when Eklund lowered the network size, and that's because he threw out all the transiting. Now, Santel's demand stayed the same on the 48 versus the 192 because they had no transiting circuits throughout the whole hearing. But So, whether Transtream's going away or not, I think the issue was, hey, if it was good in April, but then you lower the network and you throw it out, I think that's a credibility problem. And the other thing that gets me is, all you've done is you've kept your demand still in single digits, even at the 48 level, except for, I think, maybe Santel. I think one of those companies was right at the double-digit level on the 48. But I don't want some confusion on that record. I mean, I made that statement, and that statement, I believe, supported by the record, that the only time he did that was when he did the 48 analysis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions, commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Colbeck?
This is for Ms. Moore. When you said that testimony showed that the useful life of an OC-48 will be exhausted by the end of 2010, are you referring to Mr. Weber's testimony when you make that statement?
I am, yes.
And that would not be you wouldn't be referring to Mr. Eklund's testimony, is that correct?
Mr. Eklund may have said it, but it would have been based on information provided to him by Mr. Weber. And as far as the discussions that if I recall correctly, and I apologize, I don't have the transcript in front of me, so I can't point to that. But if I recall correctly, the section during which that was discussed was Mr. Weber was talking, or excuse me, Mr. Eklund was talking about his discussions with Mr. Weber, what influenced Mr. Weber's decisions as far as what networks he put in, and the fact that what Mr. Weber was putting in for these companies were OC-192s if they didn't already have them, and in a lot of other circumstances, even greater size networks. And so I think you're going to find your record support in Mr. Weber's testimony. I think there are references to it in Mr. Eklund's, but it would have been, of course, reliant upon his discussions with Mr. Weber.
And then in your brief, you stated that it's highly unlikely that the DSL voice trunk will interface with a switch without the aid of some additional equipment. Based on the testimony, isn't that somewhat of an overstatement, highly unlikely?
I don't believe so, because if I recall Mr. Weber's testimony, and I think there's a difference between if you look at the hearing testimony versus his written testimony when he talks about circuit conditioning equipment and the costs associated therewith. His written testimony is stronger than what it was at the hearing. I think part of that's human nature. When a person's being cross-examined, one's responses may not be quite as strong. But I don't think that's an overstatement, because I think what you're always having to comb those circuits into the switch at a DS1 level. And so in order to make sure that that works, getting dangerously close to talking about things I don't entirely understand. But as I understood Mr. Weber, that's simply not going to happen in most cases.
But were those costs actually included in the Flex study, those types of costs, those conditioning costs?
Not to my knowledge, no. That would have been in rebuttal to Altel's argument that there isn't a reason to differentiate between the DS0 and the DS0 special circuit.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? If there are none, Commissioner Hansen has suggested we take these items under advisement. I'm certainly not going to object to that. I think there's enough here to wade through. I'd want a little more time to reread. But we'll look to Commissioner Colbeck. Any concerns with that?
No, I don't. I understand the installation of a fiber system. In fact, I've done that up to a 192, so I get that. I understand the switch.
We can swear you in if you think you might.
No, and you seem sensitive. I get all that, but what I really do struggle with is how to make what I know come out in the finding of facts and what we have in the record. So with that, I'd have to agree with Commissioner Hansen that somebody's going to be very, very unhappy, and I'd hate to ruin their Thanksgiving if we make a decision today. The other thing
we'll just ruin their Christmas then.
Yeah, we'll ruin their Christmas instead, but. But I do struggle with trying to pull out the knowledge that in the sense that both of you make. I mean, both of you have a very valid argument, and I understand both sides. But trying to get that out of the record is extremely difficult. So I'll agree with Commissioner Hansen's motion to take it under advisement.
If we presume that Commissioner Hansen so moves.
I'm assuming I made a motion.
Okay, so be it. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Commission votes 3-0 to take no action at this time. I believe that's everything to come for all the business for the commission today. I will point to a rather lengthy list of announcements. And with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion has been made. Is there no second is required? We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you.